This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 2nd of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. First up, we head to northern Italy to the World's Exposition, which opened after a few unscheduled stoppages in Milan this May.
We get back to an experience of reality as it is, as things are, not through a representation of things. And that's what I really like. And for me, that is also what architecture is about and what architecture can do.
And later in the show, we're off to Brooklyn to sample the scents of an emerging New York perfumer with a nose for business.
It's just a brown liquid that looks like nothing. But in your mind, so many images are going off. So many things are happening in your imagination.
All that to come and plenty more besides right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up, we're off to Milan for a visit to the World's Fair. The theme of the Universal Exposition may be food, but design is an integral element used to lure in and impress the visiting droves. Once a showcase for nations to present their technological prowess and vision for the future, in recent decades the World Exposition has evolved into an elaborate exercise of nation branding, where states fly the flag and play up their soft power assets to attract tourism. One important tool of public diplomacy on show at the Milan Expo is the National Pavilion. For the architects commissioned to build them, there's a formidable test of distilling a nation's identity into a single structure. Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho caught up with the US Pavilion architect James Bieber to discuss the challenges.
The 2-kilometer-long Avenue of Nations at Expo 2015 is lined with dozens of elaborately decorated pavilions, whose purpose is to lure passersby inside to exhibits on their country's food culture. Some nations stick to stereotypes in their pavilion design. At Qatar, one finds a souk. Others opt for food references. Mexico's building has mesh sails that resemble husks of corn. For the U.S. pavilion, architect James Bieber of New York-based Bieber Architects looked to farming for inspiration.
Welcome to the USA Pavilion. So this is a food expo, and you can't design this in a vacuum and not think about agriculture, farm buildings, the tradition of agriculture. Buildings for farms are some of the most unselfconscious, direct, community built. You think about barn raisings and so on. So there's an amazing continuous ethic of architecture, a form and kind of social action, let's say, because barns had pieces that were too big for two people to carry, so they really needed a community to raise the frame. And I think it also obliges you to think about the kind of the openness of the structure. Now, here we are in Milan. It's the best possible weather. The building is a temporary building. It has no heating system. Why would you build an enclosed building? As soon as you step in front of the U.S. Pavilion on the Decumanus on the covered walkway, in less than a second, you'll completely understand the building, and you'll also understand exactly where you're invited to go, and drawn up this gigantic boardwalk ramp into a space that you can see from the outside. I don't know if it's uniquely American, but it is quintessentially American. It's this kind of linear. First of all, it's linear, and we don't really socialize in piazzas or squares. We really socialize on the street, so linear is really important to Americans. But it's also it's an edge between leisure, entertainment, food. It's a populist thing. The boardwalk is actually salvaged material from the Coney Island boardwalk, which was destroyed during Sandy. It's tropical hardwood. It has a kind of really great provenance. We are assembling without any nails or screws, so it can be taken apart and put back together again.
Explain a little bit about this vertical farm that you're doing for the pavilion.
So, lining the longest facade of the building, it's longer than a football field, it's absolutely enormous, is a vertical farm that's constantly in motion. It's like a breathing wall, actually. And so it's an array of hydroponic towers, these vertical towers invented by a professor in Laramie, Wyoming. What we have is an exhibit, is a spectacle, kind of a display. And so yes, it is using some of the technology of vertical farming, but it is doing it in a way that's much more World's Fair than Science Museum.
Now, in terms of creating the design, did you look back at past pavilions in your research?
You know, it's funny, the first time I ever went to London, I went to the V&A and I bought a book, which is a reproduction of all of the working drawings of the Crystal Palace, and which in 1851, that's the first World's Fair. And that book, I don't think I've looked at any book more in the last 25 years. It's an astonishing building. The first demountable building, you know, was moved entirely iron and glass, designed from competition to the built and filled stage in 9 months. I mean, it's an absolutely astonishing story. I did look at actually the entire history of the U.S. pavilions, the entire history of our participation in expos. And, you know, I think what you see happening is there's a kind of rise of real architectural creativity and, you know, 1939, 1964, and then even in Expo 67, you know, Buckminster Fuller's dome, you know, remarkable kind of transparent bubble, you know, it's just an amazing thing. But after funding, and one guy built actually about seven of those guys, and he's still alive, and he built the kitchen for the kitchen debates all the way through the last USA Information Agency pavilion. But as soon as funding changed from federal to private, there is a kind of degradation, I think, of the innovation, architectural innovation in these pavilions. And, you know, eventually they become, and lots do, it's not just the U.S., a lot of pavilions just become these opaque boxes with one door in, one door out, a kind of couple of theaters and a gift shop in between, and for some reason these gigantic queues outside. And we thought that is, if America is represented by a gigantic queue going through a single door into an opaque box, that would be very unfortunate. And so this notion of a really big transparent opening, this huge invitation and a ramp kind of leading you up, was very important. But it also recognizes that people attend expos at entirely different paces. You know, there are people who actually want to use it as a kind of place to relax. Recognizing all those different kinds of visits, we really tried to make the pavilion much more than one thing.
That was architect James Bieber, designer of the US Pavilion at this year's Expo, talking with our man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho. Now, on the subject of legacy, previous World Expos have left their mark when it comes to design. Landmark buildings numbering the Eiffel Tower and Mies van der Rohe's Barcelona Pavilion were constructed specifically for the event and have gone on to become long-loved and iconic pieces of urban architecture. While most national pavilions in Milan this year sought to impress by bulk, pomp, or noisy displays of digital trickery, Bahrain stood out for turning down the volume and getting back to basics. Our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho spoke with the Dutch architect Anne Holtrop, the creator of the Gulf States Pavilion, to find out more.
At Milan's Expo, countries compete to make their voices heard. Some use song and dance to get noticed. Others take a subtle approach. Next to pavilions, built with a maximum 12-meter height allowed by organizers and packed with touchscreens, sits a low-slung compound, home to Bahrain. Behind white walls, the space feels like a 1950s villa, with curving concrete panels and walkways through a garden. The hushed oasis feels like a step back in time, as its creator, Dutch architect Anne Holtrop, explains.
When I get a brief for the Bahrain Pavilion, I never visited the country. So I wanted to make something that not solely only represents, in a sense that, you know, you look at the history of a country, you look at what the present situation of countries and show this at the expo. But I also wanted to make something that, you know, forecasts the future. So on the base of the design, I made an abstract drawing, a purely geometrical drawing, which is arcs and straight lines. So when I had this drawing, I started looking at the history of Bahrain, and I saw this. I found out, you know, you have this old civilization there, the Dilmun civilization, which is 2,500 years before Christ, and there's a beautiful Barber temple found in the 50s, and it has this all different sizes of stones stacked on top of each other, curved stone elements in it, and when I saw that temple, you know, it related so much formally, so much to the drawing I made. And Bahrain was in old literature and referred to as the Gardens of Eden, or the land of the million palm trees. So it was a green oasis already for a very long time. We made a plan where we basically make an enclosed garden. It's a series of 10 gardens where we show the 10 fruit trees from Bahrain. And it's really interesting because it is subtropical. There are bananas, there are papayas, there's also olive trees, grapes. We wanted to make this enclosed because to make a kind of very specific atmosphere. So the building is never really inside. There's no glass, there's no doors. So you walk to a kind of pavilion setting, inside, outside, constantly experience these gardens in a kind of different form and a kind of different setting related to the architecture.
Besides referencing Bahrain's past in his design, Holtrup wanted to return architecture to its past role at World Expos, when buildings were more than just containers to house fancy exhibits to dazzle audiences.
When I walk around here on the expo, it feels a lot like a country branding where there's a lot of flashy screens, a lot of, you know, entertainment to attract visitors. What we do here with the Bahrain Pavilion is, as you could say, we give a very specific atmosphere. People walk in here and they experience this in a different way. You know, they experience it through the senses. Now when you walk here, you smell the orange blossom of the, you know, and the citrus blossom, which that is a fantastic smell. You know, I think we get back to an experience of reality as it is, as things are, not through a representation of things. And that's what I really like. And for me, that is also what architecture is about and what architecture can do.
That was Dutch architect Anne Holtrop. Up next at Expo 2015, we take an audio tour around the supermarket of the future.
Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, the Monocle Travel Guides. And the series kicks off with New York and with London. London can be a big beast to tame, even for the people who get to call it home. But this ever-changing and regenerating capital can also charm you with its beauty. The Monocle Travel Guide to London is a celebration of all the things that the Monocle team loves about this mighty metropolis. And they're brave enough to let you see the wrinkles too. London's a global city, but the Monocle team will help you see it as a series of friendly local gems, with this guide to the shops, restaurants, music venues and museums we think should edge their way onto your itinerary. Whether it's a mid-morning run along the South Bank, the best Greek meal at Lemonia in Primrose Hill, or a handcrafted umbrella from London Undercover, our fresh ideas will leave you with a clear, crisp view of the capital. Published by Gestalten, these books are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists. Pick up the Monocle Travel Guide to London in Monocle shops at monocle.com and in all good bookstores. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You are listening to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Back at the Milan Expo, the theme of food sparked talk of the future of agriculture and the role of technology in its production. One exhibit even questioned how we'll be shopping for it in the future too. An MIT professor has teamed up with an Italian supermarket to create just that, and their life-size grocery store allows visitors to experience this imagined future firsthand. Hungry for answers, Monocle's Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho spoke with Italian architect Carlo Ratti at the Future Food District exhibit.
The focus of exhibits at Expo is farming's future, but one pavilion gives people a taste of what food shopping may be like tomorrow. Carlo Ratti runs MIT's Sensible City Lab that looks at how digital technologies are changing our urban environment. His pavilion appears like a normal store, with hardwood floors, perfectly stacked produce, and even local producers with stands giving out samples and selling directly to clients. But on closer inspection, there's a sea of screens and motion sensors to display reams of data about products. It's a mix of old and new, says Ratti.
What we decided to do is actually to put all products on big tables. It's a bit like old markets. So the people could see each other at eye level. And as in an old market, that allows new interactions to happen between people and products, and people in people. And actually what we managed to do here in the supermarket is that there's a few sections which are managed by Italian housewives, who are the ones who can actually come and sell their products.
So I see what you've done here is, in terms of displays, you have digital readouts, a lot of the products. Just tell me what you've added to the displays in terms of the information that consumers can get.
So normally when you go to a supermarket, you've got a very limited amount of data. You've got the price, you've got the origin, but here we wanted products to tell us their stories. It's like, you know, Italo Calvino, Mr. Palomar, in his novel, goes to a store, a fromagerie in Paris, and he thinks he's in a museum. He thinks he's at the Louvre. So we like that image of how products can tell us their stories. And the important thing is that you can do this at the level of the bottle or of one apple, but also you can look at this as an aggregate for the whole supermarket. You know, what you see here in the big visualization at the end is like, you know, all of the products coming from all over the world, for sometimes for thousands of miles, coming to this place, and from this place, going into the belly of thousands of people all around Milan. And so actually being able to visualize that, being able to understand that, is the first step in order to make some of those dynamics more sustainable.
Let's just look here. We have some Italian sparkling wine on the display here. So just walk me through what the consumer would do as if they were doing their shopping. Yeah.
Well, in this case, you know, because we got the bottles, it's kind of just a corner size, so it's more like a simple touch screen, and you click on it, and you got, you know, a lot of things that you can explore about the bottle. And you can look at the next step, you can look at the footprint, you can look at nutritional values, you can look at where this is coming from which region, and, you know, here you see all the grapes in it, and a few other things. So all this information today we have online, but it's difficult to convey it on the bottle, on the... just on the labels. It's like an augmented label. Now, if you look at the other thing, however, what you do is that, you know, you don't even need to touch it. You don't even have a touch screen. You simply point at the product, and then magically there's a Kinect system that scans your hand and knows where you are, and then that information will get to you in a magic way.
With simple hand gestures, shoppers call up a product's backstory, the grower's history, and more. Its aim, Roddy says, is to put the consumer back at the heart of the food chain.
Our idea is when you got more data about products, then you can have new dynamics. Think about a future where the supermarket is only a free exchange area and everybody can be both a producer and a buyer. So think about something that you could call like an Airbnb of products, where actually people could make whatever, you know, they're good at. They could make a pie, they could cook something else for you and so on, and they can share it with each other. And then for that, then you enable a whole new layer of interaction between people and products and people, thanks to information. So yes, we can buy a lot of things online, but in many cases we want to touch something. We want to touch this bottle of wine, we want to smell it, we want to taste it. And, you know, in order to do that, we want places. Now call it a supermarket, call it something else. Maybe it will be have a different name tomorrow, but we want to create places where we can have meaningful experiences.
For more from our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho and our expo visit, go to monocle.com for a film on the subject. This is Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Now to end the show, we follow our noses to New York to meet the dynamic duo behind perfumer DS and Durga. The Brooklyn Maker movement may be more synonymous with home-cured meats and artisanal pickles than perfume, but DS and Durga's self-developed fragrance has won numerous awards since starting out in 2008. It's now stocked in shops and boutiques around the world. Our contributor Susan Stone smelled a story and visited the brand studio to send us this report.
Gowanus, Brooklyn. Construction drills clatter. The elevated train roars and rattles overhead while seagulls wheel over the polluted canal. On either side of the road, industrial-looking buildings hold busy workers. For David Seth Maltz and Kavi Maltz of DS and Durga, this is where the alchemy begins.
Perfume is invisible. It's just this colored liquid. You know, there's the packaging that's beautiful, but it's this invisible magic. And so when you open the door to this space, it was just, look, it's a raw wooden floor, white walls, high ceilings. There's nothing in here. So the fact that you can turn it into something might be a connection there.
Shiny metal cabinets and battered drawers hold the ingredients and tools used by David, the line's self-trained perfumer. He used to wait tables and played in a series of indie bands. Kavi worked as an architect.
Both our previous careers completely inform what we do now. I mean, you know, he was a musician and now he's composing scents, as we say. And I was an architect and I feel I use just the same principles of design, the same language of design. And instead of designing buildings, I'm designing, you know, graphics, packaging, and a brand, as much as I don't like that word, but yeah.
DS and Durga have created 40 scents, but currently produce an edited list of about 20. They've also developed fragrances for beauty brand Rodin, now owned by Estee Lauder, retailers Anthropologie and J. Crew, and in collaboration with whiskey maker Glenlivet. Still, commercial success and critical acclaim aren't the only things driving David Moltz.
For me, it's like very much part of my goal is to push perfume more into the world of art.
The names of their perfumes read like short story titles. Burning Barbershop, Cowboy Grass, Pale Gray Mountain, Small Black Lake. Or maybe song lyrics. One recent series, called Highlands, promises aromatic epics. It draws inspiration from Celtic legends and landscapes. Scents are packaged with poems and drawings.
Each scent I wanted to be like armchair travel. Like a book, and you can get into the world as much as you want. In Highlands, you can read the poem.
Despite the high concepts, Diaz and Durga favor a degree of straightforwardness about what goes into their complex fragrances, be it ideas or accords, those balanced blends of scent notes that harmonize together.
I want people to know as much as they can why I made it, what is in it. You know, sometimes there are accords and I'm not telling you what made that accord. You know, like if it's a saddle, of course I didn't have a saddle distilled, you know?
Well, you can see people's reactions change sometimes when they're smelling something, and as he starts to tell the story of what it's about, you can just see their kind of reaction to the scent changing because
right.
That informs how you feel about the scent.
As a next step, David Moltz has proposed a project with the Poetry Foundation of Chicago to tell a story through an aroma installation. And he recently merged playing music and making scents for the launch of El Cosmico, a new Diaz and Durga fragrance created for the high-end campground of the same name in Marfa, Texas. A machine of his own design was developed for the event.
It's a centrifugal fan and has 16 nozzles that shoot accords that I make into the fan directly from foot pedals. And I have a music project where I'm playing and singing in this band. There's four of us. The music is very like minimal and West African and evocative of deserts and popovuh, like krautrock, really dirgy and slow moving. And so as the music shifts, the scents, because it's a centrifugal fan that people will sit around, they'll be able to smell like perfumes made on the fly. Like this might just be, you know, a cedar patchouli thing, but then all of a sudden comes in a spicy labdanum and you have like a sheeper sort of going in the air.
His new band, called Copal Opal, will play mostly unfragranced shows, but David Moltz says the sonic and scented arts are for him forever intertwined.
So this is sounding all highfalutin and everything, but if we grab something, you might smell that and it smells like otherworldly. It's just a brown liquid that looks like nothing, but in your mind, so many images are going off, so many things are happening in your imagination. And so the dross is actually holding something via scent that you can't see. It's actually holding all of this like magic. And I love that idea with fragrance, that you can carry the mind off to this magical place. It's the same exact thing in music, you know?
For Monocle in Brooklyn, I'm Susan Stone.
And sadly, that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnel. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments or queries. That's all for this week's show. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.